We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 371. All right, guys, Comic-Con is fast approaching. I'm going to be releasing the panel schedule. I'm going to be moderating a bunch of panels, and we're going to have a Nerdist panel. And then also we're doing our live podcast Saturday night at the Balboa Theater, the Saturday night of Comic-Con. We have Course of the Force. It is going to be a busy, busy chunk for us, so please come join us at any or all. Why not all? Don't answer that. You can go to starwars.com/Course of the Force to get information on how to run in costume for charity for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. And if you go to nerdist.com/calendar, you can find the link that will get you tickets to the Balboa Theater. And it's close to sold out. Katie, it's close to sold out.
Good.
Thank you. And then I'll be in Philly on the 27th, 28th, and 29th of June. So again, nerdist.com/calendar for tickets to that and then other stuff coming up in the fall. I would like to thank, for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, LegalZoom.com. You're probably some kind of innovator. You've probably created something. You've probably invented a thing. Well, trademark that stuff. Incorporate. Form an LLC. Do it all at LegalZoom.com. They've helped about a million businesses get started right. They can definitely help you. Celebrate innovation with LegalZoom. And for a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code Nerdist at checkout. Protect your creations. Launch your dream at LegalZoom.com. Unless your dream is that you're riding on the back of a flying pegacorn, which is essentially a flying unicorn. I don't know if you'll be able to make that happen, but maybe you could copyright a version of that. I don't know. You decide. LegalZoom can provide self-help services at your specific direction, or they can connect you to an attorney, but they are not a law firm. Don't forget to use the referral code Nerdist, LegalZoom.com. We thank them for sponsoring today's episode, which is Fred Willard, who was on the podcast, I guess the first year of the podcast. We did a live show at Largo with Fred and Tom Kenny, and it was great. And so Fred's come back. Fred is currently on an episode of Family Tree on HBO, which is Chris O'Dowd, and it's a Christopher Guest show. And Fred Willard's on it, so it is available. It's already aired. If you have the HBO Go app, you can go watch it on HBO Go. And Fred is absolutely you just want to hug the guy and be like, "Come in for tea, Fred. Let's talk for a while." This is one of those podcasts that I feel like if I hadn't stopped it at an hour, that we would probably still be talking to Fred because he's just a really interesting guy. So here you go. This is the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 371. With Fred Willard.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Fred Willard, welcome to our podcast again. You were on the first year of the podcast.
I think I was.
You and I think it was you and Tom Kenny.
Yes, indeed. And Tom did a musical number, if I remember.
He was doing SpongeBob songs.
SpongeBob, well, was it? Yeah.
As SpongeBob.
SpongeBob what?
SquarePants.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure which SpongeBob.
No. Not the Philadelphia SpongeBob's.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
This is just SpongeBob SquarePants.
Okay.
But I think it's sort of, I think people, in general, I think people loved it, but some people always get a little freaked out when they see the human who does the cartoon voice.
Oh, yeah.
That they're always used to seeing.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of friends who do cartoon voices, and it's an amazing thing. All over the world, they're flown into these different cities. They meet people, sign autographs, and get paid a small fortune.
Yeah.
That people would not only be a fan of the cartoon, but it'd be a fan of the performer who does the voice of the cartoon. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's got to be a good feeling for those people. Because it's like, it seems so kind of anonymous in a way that no one ever knows who you are. But like, you know, the fact that the real fans kind of seek out the person who does it and is a fan of that person.
Yeah.
It's great.
Have you done a lot of voiceover stuff?
I have done quite a few things, yeah. And it's a lot of fun. I enjoy it. I don't have a big range of voices, so I usually end up just being myself.
Could you be an Australian waiter?
Australia is one of the few, one of the many dialects I can't do.
Could you
end up being English?
Could you be a British waiter?
Yes, what do we have there? What do we have there?
Where did Fred go? I was just talking to Fred.
He's right here. He's just doing a voice.
No.
I'm right here. That was
Fred. Yeah, you're live. Fred, you just missed the waiter. Did you want something? We didn't order anything.
I did. Waiter. Yes, you've had your chance to order, and I'm on my break.
Oh. Well,
boy, they have an attitude.
Yeah,
one
really
for us,
do.
They'd be speaking German. Not that that isn't a beautiful language.
It's like an auto xenophobia.
Yeah,
I'm mad at myself for being pretending to be another culture. It's hilarious. What are you working on now? What's going on?
Well, this Family Tree, the Christopher Guest series on HBO.
Yes,
I think my episode is coming up. My 3 out of 4 episodes are coming up these next 4 weeks. And I think that's doing well.
That's great.
Christopher Guest. I worked with Ed Begley Jr., Chris O'Dowd.
I like that Chris O'Dowd.
He's terrific.
Yeah, he's really funny. He's,
yeah.
I mean, when you guys all work together now, is it pretty much like, oh, yeah, this thing? Like, it's so easy. And
not really. It's always a challenge. I always compare it to walking a tightrope. You may know how to do it, but you never know if a wind is going to blow or something's going to distract you. And then there's that fall. And but this is more, this one was a little more scripted by Christopher Guest than a lot of the movies I did by him, where you just get a few pages and here's where you appear and you start to talk. So he pretty much directed me exactly what to do, pretty much what to say. And then you're pretty much on your own.
Well, at any point did you grab the script and go, this isn't how it used to be, and then, like, throw the pages
in my mind,
front of
I said that once. I saw the crew, and he said, okay, we'll turn around and do reverse angles. Reverse angles?
Who are you? I don't even know you anymore.
This shit's changed, man. Do you still like improv? Do you still?
It scares me to death. No, I don't particularly enjoy watching it. I don't. It's fun if you hit a streak. If you get up there and you hit a subject that you... You just can't stop things from flowing. It's great. And when you see wonderful improvisation, it's a crowd pleaser. But my preference is to see a written sketch. I like sketch shows. Something that's been written, rewritten, polished, and not just... It's like, to me, it's like watching someone who can type 200 words a minute. It's fantastic, you know, improv.
Yeah.
But it makes me nervous.
I got to say, you know, when people, they go, oh, improv is like the scariest thing. I think sketch is way harder because at least with improv, you can sort of bounce around if you need to.
Uh-huh.
But with sketch, all the beats have to work and make sense. And then it has to end in a way that makes sense.
And then once you start and people aren't digging it, you still have to finish it. There's no emergency exit in a sketch.
It's like a song in a weird sort of way.
Yeah.
If people hate it, but at least with music, they can sort of like, well, this is dumb, but at least I can just tune out to the music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with sketch show, the key is if you got a good lights and sound guy who can come in with really loud music.
Yeah. That's a good out.
Same in an improv. If you go to Second City, I mean, I was always amazed. You see the shows or at the Acme. Yeah, the big thing is that guy on the piano or the organ, you know, playing the music. And he's got that underlying music. And then, you know, builds to the end. And then, bam, and you think you've seen something great. when it's actually just the music.
Yeah. There's something to like a lighting guy at an improv show though. It's like they have to be just in, they have to be paying attention and just in tune to the beats and the game to know where to just black it out, which is it's always impressive to see.
It's a whole talent to do that. You got to know the actors and or if it's a slow fade or just a blackout.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you're afraid the actor's going to say, wait a minute.
Yeah, I had another beat.
And then the lights came back on.
And the lights came back on.
Oh, man, I didn't know if I was supposed to.
Yeah, like Jimmy from UCB. He's great at it.
He's been doing that. He's been with that group forever. But you really have to, you either have to have someone who's an improviser or at least someone who's been with the group. He's almost like, yeah, that guy, even though you don't see him, is like the ex member of the group, like the other whatever the
he's
extra
like the producer.
Guy is.
Yeah.
Do you miss doing, do you want to do live stuff? Do you ever miss doing live?
We do. I do a lot of live stuff. I kind of semi-run a sketch comedy group. My wife is pretty active in it. What we do, we meet once a week and aim to have a show at the Second City Theater on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
About once a month. We'll miss every few months. But at any one night you'll have 20 to 40 people in the room that come in, bring their sketches. You cast it right on the spot. Everyone tries to be supportive. That's funny. Maybe you could add this. Maybe you could add that. And the best sketches we put in the show. And it's a little scary. There's no improv. And I usually say when I'm introduced, the only improv you'll see if someone goes up in their lines. But we got a good music guy, a good lighting guy that works with us just before the show and knows where just to punch up and sound effects and in and out in 45, 50 minutes. And it's really fun. It keeps you sharp, and I really enjoy it. And it's all sketch. I've always liked that.
Didn't you guest host the Midnight Show? The sketch show over at UCB Theater.
I did.
They're a great group. They have a brand new sketch show.
That's Hal Rudnick's show, right?
Hal Rudnick, Heather Ann Campbell. It's just got like Joe Bart Chandler, like a bunch of like great performers and writers that'll just.
I didn't mean it was just his show.
There's like a bunch of great people. I guest hosted it a couple months ago, and it's just like. They all bring so many sketches every month, and like
they sit around a table preparing like a business meeting, and they have so many sketches.
So many, like every month they have so many.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah,
it's really fun, and they get into that UCB theater, and it's hardly even standing room only. It's people sitting sometimes on stage. Yeah,
yeah, it's a real chaotic show too. Like they're all so in tune with each other that it's just like it's like a rock and roll show. There's like that energy to it.
Yeah,
yeah.
If you could do any kind of show, would you rather do a sitcom or would you rather do a sketch show?
Oh boy, good. It'd have to be an awfully good sitcom. It's so tough. I like a sketch. What I like about sketches, if you don't like the plot or the characters. You know, wait a minute. It's another thing. You get in a sitcom if someone doesn't like the character or the way it's going. As you say, you're stuck for what 22 minutes here, and then I don't think I'll tune in next week.
The sitcom format. It's interesting to me that they're still. Like every year, I just expect them to go, yeah, I think that's it. There's no more sitcom premises that we can really do anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's why they're pressing the envelope now. Everything is a little raunchier, a little more further out, a little more, oh, God, could they say that? Can we do that?
Yeah. Do you feel like that's because... Because I constantly... I'm constantly disappointed in myself because I just write dirty. Like, I just have a filthy brain. And I always like, God... Why can't I be cleaner? Why can't I write cleaner, funny? Because I think there's that Cosby idea of like, you know, filth is a crutch. But it seems harder and harder to take turns to surprise the audience.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. And it's just part of our vernacular now.
Yeah. Yeah. It is tough to come up with an idea for a sketch that's never been done, never been seen, that'll surprise you. A lot of times it depends, I've found, in doing our shows, it'll depend on a funny character. In a sketch, a very colorful character. Which Saturday Night Live does that too. That's what they.
Yeah,
really,
then you can just this
for.
Person in this situation.
Yeah. Oh, here he comes again. The guy with the big hat. We have that in our show. We get some guy comes in with a character, and we say, God, you've got to do another sketch with that. You know, bring that character on, which can carry the sketch.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just watched last night the Richard Pryor special.
Oh, I've heard a lot about it.
Oh yeah, I heard it's great. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's amazing how he started out very clean, then he went very dark, then he...
You had to be clean in the 60s, pretty much, if you wanted to do television.
Yeah. And but he didn't want to be just another bland stand-up guy, so he went in the other direction.
Well, also, his life, I mean... The material that he was talking about, when he sort of made that turn and like he really just started talking about his life, and it's just that all that stuff was kind of dirty and gritty, and it sort of like that was the context. Whereas Cosby was like he's talking about his family and his kid, you know, when Jim Gaffigan made the decision to like, you know, I'm not going to really be dirty on stage. It's because he's like, why would I need to swear when I'm talking about salads? You know, like it's just sort of the material kind of.
But I don't think there's anything wrong with dirty or raunchy or anything like that. It's like, you know, some comics I loved growing up are really dirty. And there's a place for, you know, it's like there's not only like one type of music. There's, you know, very different, many shades. And I think dirty is just another thing that's just as fun to watch.
Yeah, well, I remember years ago. Red Fox, if you remember him, he had, they called them under-the-counter albums. You couldn't buy them at a record store. You have to ask for them. Oh, wait here. We got one in the back room. And they were very dirty. And he used to have a club on La Cienega, and I'd go to see it. And he was just really funny. It was just great. Very blue. My only objection is if it's very blue material is forced on an audience that isn't expecting it.
Sure.
I've done some charity shows, you know, where people come dressed very nicely and it's a wonderful, you know, charity. Yeah. We've given money. And I do one for myeloma. Mm-hmm. And you get doctors and people who donate to it, people who are suffering from myeloma, and they come in. And you get some great comedy. You get... Well, Richard Lewis, Everybody Loves Raymond.
Brad Garrett.
Ray gets a little blue, but it's always funny blue. Brad Garrett is just decimates an audience. But, you know, if you go to see him, he had his own club in Vegas.
Oh.
And you go to see him, that's what you're expecting. So there's no holds barred, and it's wonderful. People come in with a drink, and I picture a cigarette. I don't think you can smoke in a club anymore. But he just kills. But when you see it on stage and you see these, you know, 50, 60-year-old people sitting there, oh, isn't this a wonderful event? And suddenly you're talking about, you know, anal sex and blowjobs and Jesus. What did he say?
It gets hard, too, because, you know, like me and Kumail just did, we had to host this cancer benefit show. There was a friend
Why
of ours.
Why would you want to help cancer?
Yeah.
That is a terrible idea.
No, it's got a bad rap.
It really is.
It's got a bad rap. That's just thing. It's
you
a whole
picked
new
the wrong side.
It's a new campaign to try and, you know, put a smile on cancer.
No.
But like it was like for a friend of ours that was a survivor of testicular cancer, and they were giving him an award for his, you know, him helping out with cancer awareness and stuff like that. And so it was just in this big, it was in an old hangar. It was in like an airplane museum in Santa Monica at the Santa Monica airport. And it was just like that, all the people in front were just cancer survivors in tuxedos.
Oh.
And then when you get on stage, it's like you're in your head just going, don't be blue. Don't make cancer jokes. And like, it's all you can think of. So you just end up getting real tight and you can't handle it. It was real, really awkward.
Well, you feel like the stakes are much higher emotionally, but I feel like, you know, in general, you know, I don't think anyone would want to feel like it. And almost in a way, you don't want to be patronizing because no one wants that.
Yeah. It was right after like a really emotional speech where people were crying.
Oh yeah.
And it was just like, and now time for the comedy. And like Kindler was there.
Really,
and it was just, yeah, it was real, real weird.
How'd it go?
It was fine. You know, we were making our friends laugh. I made a Breaking Bad reference, and it just went flat. And I was really expecting it to be the big one.
Oh, you thought they would really connect with
that?
Yeah,
and we made a bunch of, like, you know, one testicle jokes that seemed to do pretty well.
That seemed to do pretty well.
Yeah, it's considering.
Yeah, the people who looked around and said, well, I've got both testicles, so I can laugh.
Yeah, exactly.
And the guys with one testicle had to laugh to be good sports.
Yeah, exactly.
And you never want to be like, this motherfucker knows what I'm talking about. Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, no,
because it was for a friend of ours, Jack Hergerth, and like it was a... He was like the one that got me a pilot for Comedy Central a while back. And like I was like, when this guy offered me a pilot at Comedy Central, I was like, this guy's got ball.
That's a great joke.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great joke.
Then if you get a heckler with a very high voice, I'd kill to have one testicle. You think you have problems?
You think you, Nick, have problems?
Hey, well done.
Thank you.
Well done. It is comedy in the, you know, it is... It is sort of the – it really can be powerful in that sense of this is the thing that we all are trying to deal with, and it can take the tension out of it. But it is that, you know, it's a dicey road, you know.
Well, do you make a joke? I mean, it's like the old thing about someone who's in a wheelchair. You open the door for them or something. Do they get annoyed? I can handle it myself.
Yeah.
I remember once years ago, I was living in Hollywood, and there was a guy with a wheelchair. He was going down the street. And I thought, he seemed to be going to the market down the corner. I said, I should just go up and say, look, let me wheel you down there. You'll get there quicker, but I never did. I thought maybe he might react badly.
Well, that's what
I can do it myself.
You just do it and you don't say anything.
Yeah. Oh, just grab the wheelchair. Yep. Well, yeah. That could be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just start.
Here we go.
Just start singing.
It is that sort of because you don't want to be the annoying person who's like, you go, I'm going to be helpful, and then you just make everything way worse.
Yeah.
Like when my friend Mike and I were in college, Mike Furman. We were in Westwood, and there were a lot of homeless people in Westwood. And so Mike was walking by this guy who was sitting on the sidewalk, and the guy had a Coke cup. And so Mike just had some change, and he dropped it in the cup. And the guy just looked down. He was like, what the fuck are you doing? And Mike was like, oh, no! Like, he was just a guy. Like, all Mike saw was just the cup out, which was not an uncommon thing to see in Westwood.
Yeah.
And the guy just was on a break or something, and Mike just put his change in the guy's cup.
I want to just start doing that. I just want that to be a trick now. If you just see someone with a cup, just throw money in.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
It
may not go well at the moment, but afterwards it's a great story.
I think a couple months after, your eye clears up and your nose is healed.
It's not for that immediate audience. It's for the bigger audience.
Yeah, you'll get it on the way home.
Do you feel that comedy's changed or evolved anyway in the last, you know, couple of decades, or do you feel like, oh, it's always, you know, when every generation thinks that they're new and edgy or whatever, really they're doing the same stuff?
We get a lot of new people that come into our group, and we love to have new people and see their take on things. But after a while, you realize that it's just a different take on something that's been funny for years.
Yeah.
You can, as I say, push the envelope further. You can use more graphic language. You can touch on subjects you never could before. If you ever hear, you know, I listen to comedy radio a lot, on Sirius Radio. Every once in a while, they'll put on a Henny Youngman tape. And if you ever listen to him, it's actually funny how there's actually no segue from one joke to the other. Versus his wife, then his mother-in-law. Then I was standing in front of his, hey, here's another thing. And it almost gets funny for that. But each one, you know, today comics kid themselves about not having a good segue. You know, I'll hear a comic say, well, that was no segue there.
Yeah.
And some the other night I heard I had a good one. He says, speaking of funny... you can explore more topics and just stretch the envelope more. I think that's the only thing. And there's more things to make fun of.
What?
The internet, cell phones. You know, back when I was a kid, the only thing was, you know, a comic would come out with a tuxedo and a lot of rings, just up from Miami Beach. And what else? You talk about the mother-in-law. His car broke down. That's about it.
If only there was some worldwide web of information that we all shared that I could make fun of.
I guess because there's more mass knowledge about more things, there's more for people to relate to.
There's more people to relate to, but also the downside to that is now everyone has seen everything. It's harder to surprise people because they just have, you know, just everything in their pocket, literally everything that you like, all of our knowledge, all of our entertainment, all of everything is just right here. And before, I think it was maybe they were talking about like the breadth of topics were smaller, but also people's breadth of knowledge was smaller.
Yeah.
So it was easier to surprise them. Like the guy doing the mother-in-law jokes in Miami, like other people, you know, in another city, probably hadn't heard those yet.
Yeah.
But now everyone's heard everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's see. What happened the first way? Well, there was Red Fox. And then Lenny Bruce, when he came, I mean, he just touched on subjects that nobody ever touched on. I remember I was very young and someone would say, you got to hear this guy's album. And he was talking about the Pope coming to the Catholic Church. You never heard this stuff. Talking about Hitler, making jokes about Hitler. And but he came in with a whole wave that wasn't particularly blue, you know, Bob Newhart, Mort Saul, Nicholson May. But then there's different waves that come along. Monty Python changed how you look at sketch comedy. There didn't have to be a punchline at the end. It's just someone come in and say, stop this foolishness right here. It's too silly.
Or they would just focus on something on the desk, and then that thing would be the thing that would drive the next sketch.
It would always probably be just like, we don't know how to end it. Just get Gilliam to do something weird.
Yeah, literally, I think they really did.
But what's very popular now is improvisation. And I finally realized what I think it's very popular because the audience becomes part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see when Second City, I spent a year at Second City, and I was in Vegas, and they'd have a Second City show. And one night I went, and it was the guy at the door says, "It's our all improv night." I said, "Oh, cripes, I didn't want to see it." So I went in anyway, and they start out with a few blackouts, good laughs. And then I realized they'd asked the audience for suggestions. And if some guy's suggestion was taken and his whole table, then they were in on it. They loved it. It didn't have to be that funny, but, oh, he took up my suggestion. Mm-hmm. So it gets the audience involved.
Yeah.
And so the audience feels like they're really part of the show. That's what audiences want to be, part of the show.
Yeah.
Well, it's fun. I mean, with stand-up, I'd say about 40% of my show is just screwing around with the audience. And the what can be hard is to follow your crowd work with jokes that you wrote that are not about that audience because they're so engaged, and all of a sudden you're like, frozen peas are strange, you know, or whatever you go into.
Yeah, the idea.
Note to self, right? Great frozen pea bit.
But it's just like, there's a thing you do sometimes, in stand-up where you go up and you just like, I'm just going to, riff around, be in the moment, have everyone know that you're there with them in that space and time. And then it's just, there's always that awkward jump where you just like, and then maybe they don't feel that you are jumping into material, but you know it and you just reek of it. just that pre-planned, like, here we go.
What's sort of the perfect sketch show for you? Is it, do you have any interaction with the crowd at all? Or?
Well, I usually talk to them. We open with a number, a couple of shows we open. We have a guy who does a great, Richard Horvitz. He does a lot of voices, and he's one of the guys I'm talking about that flies all over the world and signs autographs. He does Gracie Allen. We have Bill Farmer, who's Goofy down in Disneyland. And he did George Burns. So we opened the show with Burns and Allen. Just talking. That was spot on. The guy that does Gracie Allen went out and bought a dress and a wig. Then they introduced me. I come out and I talk to the audience because I feel they probably want to. It's a small theater. So it kind of break the wall there. And talk not too long because I can't be that funny for that long. Maybe a minute and a half. So a joke about the theater. So, and it's hard to mix stand-up with sketch stuff because it's... And then the perfect show is some very thoughtful sketches, some very physical sketches. And then we have I have a friend, T. Sean Shannon.
I know T. Sean.
And he comes in with some very blue material,
mm-hmm.
but always funny. So we try to close the show. So in case people in the audience don't want to hear, and we find our crowd doesn't want to hear too much blue material. You can see that at the improv, the comedy store. So a lot of times I find our audience get a little offended if it gets too graphic. But the last couple of sketches can be pretty blue, and then we're out. Good night. Thanks for coming.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
It also lets the younger people in the crowd know, this isn't, they can still get blue material.
Right.
Which is important. You don't want to be like the church, Sunday we're going to have Christian comics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And
all clean family comedy.
That's right.
Or just not comedy.
Isn't it crazy how much the Lord loves you?
Yeah.
What?
I hear a few of those on...
on the comedy radio?
Yeah, and it's very interesting. It's very unusual. And yet a lot of times I'll go to a show and I'll, for 40 minutes, be laughing and suddenly realize there hasn't been a blue line said there, if they don't announce it.
Yeah.
Then if they announce it, then you're aware of it. Oh, it could be funnier.
Well, if you're of whatever sort of religious community, whoever's, it's probably very funny to those people because they all at least understand the references and they understand the mindset of it. If you're an outsider,
there are Christian comics that just like just like that have huge careers, just like Christian rock,
right.
There's bands that make millions of dollars and comics that make tons of money, but you'll never hear about them because it's a very segmented part of the population.
Christian rock is Chris Rock's religious comedy. Hey, thank you. Thank you very much.
Don't sit on it. Just move along.
If it weren't racist, I'd riff the character. Damn it! Damn these constraints.
I get it. Chris Rock. Christian. What would happen if Chris Rock decided to perform in front of a... I would do a minute on that, but I can't do Chris Rock.
I can't do it.
You can do Chris Rock.
No, I can't. I can't even really do his voice. I can't All really right. do his voice without, yeah.
A good way to get into it is just one rib. You just got to say that. And it's a line from a movie.
It is. Yeah. No, you're allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're ruling. Yes. Yes, you are. You yes. are indeed allowed to do that. There is that sort of comic thing, though, when you feel the audience is getting a little uncomfortable. When I think when you're a younger comic, you're like, oh, what I really need to do is push them farther. It'll get funny eventually. Uh-huh. And it's like it rarely ever works out in the positive in that sense. There is that.
But Bill Burr's good that way. That comedian Bill Burr, where he just, you know, he starts off a premise by pushing people away.
He's unique, though, because he is an exceptional guy. Like, you have to be Bill Burr's level of comic.
Yeah, yeah.
To be able to do that and to be able to really not just ride the wave of the audience, but actually create the wave pool and then ride the wave of the audience, which is a whole separate thing.
How do comics, they stand up, what's their big thing to break in? Doing, like, the Letterman show, or is that... Because I see a lot of comics, and I watch them, and I say, they're very funny. But then you don't hear anything else about it. But, of course, I don't I hesitate to go to a stand-up comedy show because I've gone to some, and you can hit some very unfunny comics waiting for your favorite comic to come on. So what's the best step if you're a young comic? I'm sure you want to get on Conan or Letterman.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because I've done Conan, and it's it just seems like very happenstance. It's just, you know, it's one of those things you just kind of keep on plugging away.
Yeah.
And what I think that, and this is kind of like, it sounds, you have to perform as much as you like hang out. I think hanging out is a big part of it because, you know, if you do a show and you kill and then you're gone, no one's going to have a chance or opportunity to go like, hey, you should come and do this show. And then it's like maybe a better show. And then that's like the one that maybe the Conan or Letterman guys go to and stuff like that. So it's real all very happenstance.
It doesn't really, I mean... It's a cool thing to, I mean, if you're a comic, you want to do the shows, you know? I don't think it really helps so much anymore. It's cool. It's a cool thing to do. And, of course, you know, you want to have your checkbox of things that you've done as a comic that sort of legitimize you. You're like, oh, he's done this, he's done this. But it's pretty rare that any one performance on anything, especially now, really changes anything.
Yeah, someone was just telling me, I was doing an interview and someone was telling me, like, well, you know, a lot of comics think this, you know, doing a half hour, which I just did, like a half hour would, like, change your career or benefit. And I said, really all it is in the end is just, like, another thing for them to put on after your name on a flyer. That's, like, really, in the end, it's just like a, and then he was on this. Like, that's it. That's the only real, like, it's benefit you get.
It's the comedian equivalent of, like, you know, MA or PhD or...
Yeah, exactly.
That's in Little Ad, and then you see go to town, there's a comedy club, so-and-so, as seen on David Letterman.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that will draw people out. Say, oh, he's at least funny enough to be on Letterman.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not just a complete amateur who's going to waste my time. Yeah. So that's the...
Do you have any... Would you ever want to tour at all, or do you... Like...
I did that years ago when I was... I was on a show, Fernwood Tonight.
Of course. And we talked about this on your own before. Yeah, that show's amazing.
Yeah, and I went out, and some guy who had a club in San Francisco kept urging me to come up and do the show by myself. And I didn't have enough nerve to do that. I went up with a band. We did some music, and I did some stand-up comedy. And it was great when people come to see it because they know you. Everything works. Everything. And as I look back, I could have done more stuff because they were just there not to judge you. But then if every once in a while you hit an audience... that does know who you are. It's midnight on Saturday night. They've had a few drinks. And I just didn't enjoy it. I didn't have the feeling of, I'm going to stay on until I get these people. They don't like me. I don't. Okay.
I don't care.
Good evening. Thanks for coming. Go to another place. So, yeah, long answer to a short question. No, I wouldn't consider. Yeah, I might if someone. It would depend on what kind of places.
Yeah. Mm. San Francisco is a great comedy town.
That was the place when Robin Williams came out of there. Every place was a comedy club. Every street had a comedy cellar, the comedy bar, and the comedy... Cobb's Comedy Club is still there.
Cobb's is still there. It's I think I'm playing Cobb's in the fall. It's a giant room.
Uh-huh.
The Cobb's now, it used to be like a tiny little room.
Oh, really?
On the, you know, like down in the water, by the water, near the pier. And And I think the room caught fire or something, and then they were like...
And it wasn't close enough to the water.
No, the blackout!
And it's, it wasn't close enough to the fucking water. That's the problem.
Lights! Where are the lights? It's supposed to go out now!
I love the joke, Fred. Can you cut out fucking?
It
yeah.
doesn't work without it.
I don't think I can fucking do that.
Now, listen. I've worked at Cobbs. I was there with Martin Mull. We did a tribute to... Fernwood Tonight, yeah. And then I do something called, in their own words, Celebrity Autobiography.
Yep.
I don't know if you've heard that. You get about six actors and you read from celebrities' autobiographies. And the guy, the producer, picks out the funniest segments that these celebrities have written, assuming the book is going to be aimed just at their fans. But some of them sound pretty ridiculous out of context. But anyway, we did several shows there at Cobbs Comedy Club in... San Francisco, and it's a great room. It just seems to fill up for anything, and they come to see comedy, and they're great.
Yeah. Well, it fills up if you're you. It's not, it can be a little tricky sometimes. It can be a little tricky.
It is a big room.
It is.
High ceilings. How big is it?
It holds,
like six. How fucking big is it, I meant to say.
Fred's so new
big.
Direction.
It's a big fucking room. What do I know?
It's so big. The Giants were playing the Dodgers. We didn't fill the place. It's a big room there. They played indoors. It was a big booking. We thought it would go well.
I think the idea is to try to see if you can use the F word, but not, but make it feel weird in the sense that... that tonally and contextually you wouldn't expect it. You're like, how many fucking people do you think that fucking Cobbs holds?
How cute is this fucking baby?
That's a very cute fucking baby.
Yeah.
You're fucking cute for fucking asking me about your fucking baby.
Fuck you, fucker.
Oh, you're fucking adorable.
How about we were having fucking premarital sex? I was being fucking intimate with my lady friend.
We were having fucking love.
That's it. Yeah. We were making fucking love. Yeah, well, this is a whole...
You're the light of my fucking life. I fucking love you.
We were making anal fucking sex. But why did you leave the last part? It just fucking... I like to use it with like a word that's really tame. Like, look at those fucking gams. Like, fucking... And then gams? Why would that...
I like the guy that... It's a thing I like to do with my friends where it's like the guy that like is like good at talking dirty but always like fails with the like sticking the landing. It's like, hey, Chris, did you go check out that girl and grab her sweet, wet woo-woo?
Whoa. Oh, sorry. It just got weird at the end. Yeah.
Did you take your wiener and put it up
your
thing?
Don't say that. That's way worse. Yeah. That Patton has that old bit where...
Oh, where the clean version of a dirty joke.
Yeah, like what you're not allowed to say on television. You couldn't say like, oh, I totally fucked this girl. Yeah. But, you know, he was like... But this is something that I can say on television. It's way worse. I want to fill your hoo-ha with goof juice. It's like, that's way worse.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It takes the romance out of it. Takes the edge off of it.
Do you like being the? I mean, like, you know, it was like with a show like Fernwood, where you sort of get to be the reactor in the scene. Like, is that?
I think that's what I like the most. Yeah.
Yeah.
To do something real and react off someone else. That's why I don't enjoy doing stand-up that much. I always like to do sketches, or I've worked with partners, and when I work with Christopher Guest, you're reacting off somebody. So it's a little more real to me. I like it. To me, it's so strange to get up in front of an audience, and I've never had a strong enough point of view to really rock an audience for an hour, you know. This is my point of view. What are we going to do about this? So I started out, I wanted to be an actor. That was the thing. So I tend more anything that's acting.
And when you started, so it wasn't really necessarily a comedy thing first in terms of, were you just auditioning for anything, drama, comedy?
Yeah, that? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you're trying to find what do I want to be? But I found even though I do dramatic things, it, there was a tone of comedy in it. So I found I was just more comfortable doing comedic things. And personally, I like comedy more. I, every once in a while, I'll go to a very dramatic movie. And I say, why am I going to go to this? I just want to laugh.
Yeah.
I want to go someplace where I can laugh. And the reason I like stand-up comedy, you can go for an hour and watch and laugh. You can go to a Broadway show that can be very funny, but you don't laugh that much in 2 hours. But stand-up, you can laugh and, really funny.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. And the key, I think, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, is insight. You go to see a comic who's gets on some topic that you thought only you were interested in, or something that only bothered you. I'll think in a minute of what a perfect thing that just I just listened to, and I said, "Geez, it seemed to be something that only bothered me."
Well, there is that idea that, you know, that comedy is really about one of the major facets of comedy is that you're exposing a truth that, you know, yeah. it's that idea where people are like, "Oh yes," you know, and then they all. You know, there's that very sort of communal thing, uh-huh. which feels very primitive to me and sort of tribal and like, ah, we are all in the same tribe. Ha, 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 ha. We are not going to murder each other. Yeah. Ha, ha, you know, there's a safety in it. You know, there's a safety in throwing out ideas that other people immediately relate to and like, oh, we're all part of the same tribe.
Uh-huh.
That maybe comedy saved people yeah. from being murdered. At some point, because it expressed a kinship,
or you feel suddenly that you're not nuts for being bothered by something. And here, this guy's on stage,
yeah,
talking about the same thing,
yeah.
And I remember some young actress, one of these actresses that's always on drug charges and doing this. She was doing some interview, and one of her pet peeves is people who don't use their turn signal.
Yep, sure.
And I said, oh, geez, I kind of like her now that she had the same. Because that's one thing that drives me nuts, that someone will sit there and or they'll be coming down the street and you wait politely for them to come. You don't want to pull out, and slowly they turn.
Yeah.
And you want to.
I always hate it when they're mid-turn and then the signal goes on.
Because they think that is a part of the car that helps the turn.
Yes.
They think they have to turn on the turn signal. It's like turning the wheel and taking your foot off the brake.
I always think that it's just a form of nostalgia. Like, remember when I started turning and didn't want to tell you?
Yeah.
Like, that always gets fucking mad.
Well, I remember when I started to drive, you'd use hand signals. Left, I kind of forget, straight arm and a left turn.
And then there, down? Was it down?
I can't remember. Yeah.
Up, I think, was a right turn and down, but people think you were crazy now. They think you were a choo-choo.
I see cars that, like, clearly, like, their blinkers are broken, and they're just doing that. But, like, they don't even really do the signs properly. They just kind of just point to where they're going. Yeah.
I think bicycles do it now. I see yes. them do turns.
But it almost looks like they're ordering, like, you stay back.
Yeah. Just hold it there.
Yeah, that's it. Nothing to see here.
You don't tell me what to do. I'll drive right through your fucking arm, buddy. Don't give a shit. You're
not whereas the turn signals are more formal. Maybe they come down from some central location.
Yeah.
It's a turn signal. Well, you got to observe this.
Are you writing any books anytime soon, or what are you gonna do?
Write a book? Well, I wrote I wrote a movie. I got an idea for a cartoon thing. I got to figure out what to do with it besides just tossing in the trash. I used to write things, but I'm easily dissuaded. I used to write. Ideas. I'd take it out like by the third person who'd say, "Well, no, it's not for us." I'd say, "This is the stupidest thing. What am I even doing here? Wasting their time." Until you read about great, great movies that were shopped around to studios and were turned down. So you got to have perseverance, which I really don't have. But every once I sit down and write something, work on something.
I think it's hard. I think what's weird about comics in particular is that with any kind of comedy, you know, you sort of rely on this relationship with the audience, and if you try a joke 3 or 5 times and an audience just doesn't respond, then you go, all right, well, I guess, you know, unless you love it so much that you don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it's sort of like, well, I guess this doesn't work. And so I can see that translating where with anything, whether it's a script, you're like, oh, yeah, well, I guess, okay, well, I thought this was good, but I don't know. You know, it's like, it's relying so much on the other side to validate the thing.
Yeah.
I've done things both in a stand-up act and in sketch shows that I dropped after a while, you know, and years later, someone will say, you used to do that bit about, I love that thing with you did with the guy who was...
the guy who loved pickles. Remember that bit?
Yeah,
no, I don't...
And then you have to... If you can't find the script, you have to rewrite it. And then you do it again, and it's very funny.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I think it's maybe the different time, or maybe it's in what it's in context, the audience.
Yeah, I'll do that sometimes, where I'll just go back to old, like, you know, notebooks and be like, oh, maybe with fresh eyes now I can make this work.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works. Like, yeah, there's, like, stuff that I tried years ago that just bombed, and then I tried now with, more knowledge, maybe more experience, then that's when it works.
Yeah.
Do you ever host shows? You ever thought about hosting shows?
Well, what do you mean? Like I'll do, every once in a while there'll be a charity, and so they'll call me and say, we'd love you to host it. And I say, oh, no. But then what it does... I do. I pull out old material and I write stuff for the particular thing, and it actually ends up being great. And sometimes I'll find out I'll be on stage and just think of things spontaneously. Let's see, where the hell did that come from? And I say it, and it gets a laugh. But it's a pretty supportive audience, and so it's fun. You're moving things along, and I tend the hardest thing about do you host things, Chris?
Yeah. I host stuff.
Well, you come out, you do your few minutes up front, and then you suddenly I don't want to come out and do another chunk. What I was like, okay, our next act or our next presenter. But then you try to think of things.
MCing is kind of a bummer because even if the crowd's nice to you, by the fifth time you're on stage, they're like, well, yeah, I get it.
That's why you just run it along at that point.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I'm just going to keep this moving.
And if I'm in the audience, you're looking at your watch. No, now we still got the auction. And
I just meant like we still have to – I just meant the, you know, like – yeah, like game show stuff. You ever thought about like hosting a?
Love to host a game show.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, seems like it'd be just great. They do five in a day, and you read everything off a cue card. Yeah.
Did you ever do Hollywood Squares?
Oh yeah, I did it in the old day when Peter Marshall was the host.
Whoa!
When I was starting out, they would take us to Vegas and put us up in these suites at the Riviera, and we do like five of them in a day.
Wow.
And I remember Paul Lynde.
Yes.
Oh, God, he was funny. He was so funny until he had a couple of drinks, and then you just didn't want to be around him.
Oh.
And
was he just kind of mean?
Oh, he would just – there was no holes barred with it. But, when you know, he'd wear a caftan down by the pool. And just he was wonderful. And we were at parties with him, and once he sat down with my daughter at the piano. She was just really tiny. He showed her how to play the notes on the piano. He was just wonderful.
And then he had a couple of drinks, and he was like, you're terrible. Yeah. Like, what are you doing? It's a child.
What were we talking about? Oh, yeah, Hollywood Squares. And then I did it with, later I forget who hosted it. And I didn't know they wrote jokes for you.
Mm-hmm.
Until one day Paul Lynde said something and there got no laugh. He said, oh, I'm sorry, that's the wrong punchline. And I thought, oh, they write jokes for him. But I came up with my own jokes. But it was great fun. I didn't ever host it, but I was one of the squares.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever actually hosted a game show. I've been on a lot of them.
Yeah, I see. I could totally see you hosting like a fun sort of a match gamey type thing.
Yeah.
Or like a fun, I don't know, just like a... You know, not so much a formal game show, but in the sense of, you know...
You don't want to have this. Good evening, and time to play.
I'm Jack Barry.
And tune in next week when our... Yeah, you want to be a little of that. You know,
yeah.
But still, fun guy. Drew Carey, you know, he does that great thing, and it would be a great job.
Well, Price is Right I actually think Price is Right would be kind of a fun show to host.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
It's like a party.
It's like everyone's excited to be there. You're giving them money. There's like a new car. There's games.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a slick
job.
And you
seem very smart when you're hosting a game show. Yeah. You're a little above everyone.
Yeah.
It's like the principal who's come into the class.
Yes, exactly. It's almost like there's almost this weird conceit that whoever's hosting the show must have been an expert in whatever this thing was, and that's why they were promoted to run the ceremony.
I'm sorry, you're so close, but that's not right.
Trebek would talk, like Alex Trebek. I remember, like, I would always, his sort of take, and maybe he does know all the answers to everything, but it was you know, where it's like, oh, I'm sorry. Correct answer was the Norman invasion. Common mistake, though, thinking it was D-Day or whatever. So you're like, it's not a common mistake. Uh-huh. It might be a common mistake at weird academic societies.
Yeah,
but it's just that, because I did, I was on Jeopardy in 97, and he sort of had that tone where it was, where he was, I don't know, it wasn't really... It wasn't like he was there having fun. It was almost like he was a little above you.
He was there drinking.
Yeah, I don't know if he was drinking. But I was hosting a show for MTV, which was a stupid dating show, and I missed an answer, and he kind of gave me like the common mistake thing, and I was like, I know all the answers on my show, too. And then that just did not endear me to him in any way.
Oh, jeez.
Who else was I did Are You Smarter Than a Sixth Grader? And I said, I think I am. And I really studied for that thing. And I tried to think what they did. Are you smarter than a fifth grader, I think. And I learned about American geography, and there's a lot of things you don't know about American geography and where countries are. And it got up, I was playing for charity, and the final question was like $200,000 international geography. And Jeff Foxworthy said, now, Fred, I would advise you, he said, the geography has changed since we were in class. So I skipped. I just stuck with the money I'd earned. And the question was, what is the body of water to the east of India? I said, oh, my God, I don't think fifth graders study that. I think when I was in fifth grade, you were still learning about Washington, D.C. and the state of Washington. And the correct answer was the Bay of Bengal. Oh, you knew that?
Yeah.
Jonah has a fifth grade education.
Yeah, that's where I stopped. I figured it was all I needed to know.
And how many times are you asked that, I bet? What is
this
that
was
body
the first
of water?
Time. Yeah.
Finally!
It's not the Indian Ocean. It's something else.
Well, So I was very glad I didn't make a step.
Did the kid get it right?
Oh, the kids knew it. Boy, those kids had their hands up. They were very bright. So someone's getting a good education today.
It's not fair, though. You know, like, they make it... That's sort of the... You know, those kids have their... Well, at least the academic... The ones who are a little more predisposed to studying... Their brains are just immersed in those facts all the time.
Yeah.
So
I think they probably coach them on not the questions, but probably in that, you know, let's study geography in the Middle East or over there. You know, let's review where the oceans are and then where Russia and Mongolia. Yeah. I mean, I thought I had a good education. We'll be watching television. My wife will say, where the hell is, you know, name some country. She said, geez, I don't know where it is.
Because that information, that place where that information would live is taken up with other dumb adult-like things.
Yes, thank you.
Do you want to make an interesting show? Are you stronger than a fifth grader? That, I think, would be an interesting show.
I think I could do that. Maybe, can you run faster than a fifth grader? Maybe not run faster, but could beat up a fifth grader.
You could beat up a fifth grader.
Yeah. Could you? And it's like a moral show.
Yeah.
Could you beat up a sixth grader?
Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
Most of my adult life, no.
Yeah,
most of my adult life, I would not be able to.
Speaking of game show hosts, and I don't know what show he does. He's Wayne Brady.
You must know Wayne.
He is fantastic. And he's hosting this game show. He does a great job. I worked with him on a show called Trust Us With Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen improv that like he does.
He's got a supercomputer in his head.
It is. It's amazing.
And you never see him working.
No.
That's the thing. Is like some people, when you see them doing improv, like you can sort of see the wheels turning in their head.
Yeah.
But with him, it's just like this. It's just he's always got this kind of calm look on his face.
In the moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw him actually laying on the ground, and he seemed to rise up and just, you know, rise like Jesus would rise. And on his feet. And after the show, I said, Wayne, how did you do that? He said, well, you got a bag of tricks. I said, I've never seen the bottom of that bag of tricks. He broke into a Mick Jagger one day. You'd think he was doing Mick Jagger. I remember years ago at the Acme, I used to host a midnight show there, and no one knew who he was at the time. He was in a group called House Full of Honkies, who have all split up now. But he and we would try to decide who wanted to do which improv, and I'll do anything. He was game for anything. Musical improv, yeah, I'll do it. I was just amazed then. I said, this guy's just super.
Well, he's one of those guys that, you know, I think people, if they're super, you know, like snarky in particular, and like, I'm like punk rock comedy, like, Wayne Brady, fuck that TV guy. And then they watch him and they're always like, he's fucking good.
He's good.
Yeah, it is
he's
good.
Really
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
He's just one of those guys that really does do, like, he really does do everything.
It's from another, like, he's from another planet.
Mm-hmm. He is. Who else have you known throughout the years where you're like, shit, that person's just too, they're just too in another plane?
Oh, well, John Cleese, I saw him years ago on Broadway in some show, and I remember Oxford-Cambridge Review, I was very young, and I saw it. This guy, he just stood out in my mind. And then next time I saw him, he's on.
Really, you saw him in a university review type show?
No, it was on. Yeah, Oxford Cambridge Review. But he did. I can still remember a sketch he did. And who else? It's just my friend Martin Mull. His comedy comes from another world.
What was the sketch that Cleese did at the?
Well, he was interviewing someone for a job, and he was supposed to. And the secretary. I don't remember exactly, but he said to the person he was interviewing, he says, would you get me a cup of coffee? Can you play tennis? He just got it mixed up there. And I was very new to comedy. I said, it was so bright. He had the right attitude. but Wayne Brady stands out, Colin Mockery can do things. You know Colin Mockery?
Mockery and Ryan Stiles is...
Ryan, yeah. Yeah, those guys are just have taken improv to another, just another level. It's like someone once said about professional tennis, it's another game.
Yeah.
You say, I play tennis. No, it's another game.
Yeah.
What they do is another...
And occasionally you bat the ball back and forth. Those people actually play tennis. Yeah,
I sat courtside at professional tennis games, and it's not a matter of, you know, trying to get the ball in. It's just hit it as hard as they can. They know it's going to go in.
Yeah.
But they just hit it as hard as they can, and it's whap, whap.
It's like the grunting game, especially like men's tennis is all... Argh!
Yeah.
I heard they had to kind of keep that in check.
Why?
Like, I heard it was starting to become a distraction, and so they had to ask tennis players to just keep down the grunting.
This is like they put a shock collar like a dog.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, you know what? You know. It's like the joke about the parrot. There are people you... In a different level, yeah.
So you've got the Christopher Guest show that you're
That's coming up. I hope I'm okay. It's a funny show.
Do you kind of know what you're doing for the rest of the year? Or do you just sort of
no? Things come up, or hopefully they come up. I did the next Anchorman movie. That was great.
Yes,
that was very fun. That was wonderful. I was down there with all the guys. Felt so much a part of it.
I'm so excited for that.
Was that his big? What couldn't have been his biggest movie? But everyone, ever since he announced he was doing Anchorman 2, fans will just say, "Are you in the new Anchorman?" For a long time, says, "I don't know."
Who will?
No, people would ask me that.
Oh, people would ask you that. Oh, yeah.
Hey, are you in the new Anchorman movie? I said, I don't know, because they were still writing it up until they just started filming it.
Wow.
So I don't know if that was his biggest hit. I don't know. Who knows grosses, but...
I think it was his breakout hit.
Yeah.
It was the thing that made him a superstar.
Are you talking about Will, or are you talking
Will,
about...
Bill Ferrell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were talking about...
Adam McKay?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of one the same.
Nah.
It's like they kind of, you know...
No one's ever seen them in a room together. Yes, they have. Yes. They've seen them together
Many rooms.
All the time. How long was Anchorman 2 fun? Obviously it was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Do you feel like they, you know, I don't know. This is sort of a dumb question because it's not like you're going to go, I really didn't find it funny at all. Like, it was probably great.
I was judging. And the thing that annoyed, they could tell I was judging because I was sitting back smoking my pipe.
During scenes.
That's right. Fred, it's your line. What? Oh, I
no, fuck
note.
You. It's your line. What? That makes sense. I'm excited for Anchorman 2. I actually think... You know, sometimes when you hear, like, oh, they're going to make a sequel all these years, and you're like, oh, I don't know. That's actually one where I could see, you know what, they actually could, that group of guys could actually make that super funny.
Yeah. Sure.
And those characters, it's a bummer when you see, you know, especially with a movie, you see it once, and you're like, damn it, I'm never going to get those characters again. Like, that was it.
Yeah.
That was it.
But I think that's the kind of movie people will flock to even... Before they realize, is this good or bad? It's just been there.
Yeah.
It's like Hangover 3. People go to see it, and the reviews of Hangover 2 were terrible, but still it made billions, and that's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
I'll take bad reviews to a couple of million dollars.
To millions of dollars.
And I worked with, since the last time I talked to you, Jerry Lewis.
What?
That was amazing, yes. I got a call. They're doing a movie with Jerry Lewis.
Who's
Would
doing
you like
a movie?
To, a guy wrote the script, sent it to Jerry in Las Vegas. Jerry said, and this is from the guy who wrote, he said, I haven't done a movie in 8 years, but I think I owe this one more. And it's called The Friends of Max Rose. And he plays a man about his own age, like himself, who's lost his wife, and he's kind of losing it all because he thinks he can still talk to his wife. I play his doctor. And... the first thing you hear now today is that there's really no money. I said, well, you know, that's beside the point. I'd never met Jerry Lewis. And it was just, I couldn't get over, you know, I worked 2 days on it. And just sitting opposite him, sitting next to him, in the back of my mind, it was, I'm sitting here talking to Jerry Lewis. Because he had so many, the Dean Martin years, the muscular dystrophy years, the out of control years. Right. I was angry. I was so nervous the night before I went in. I said, is he directing this movie? Am I going to come in? And is he going to say, you come on a set and not prepared? That's what I was afraid
right.
of. But I got there and the director came to me and he said, now Jerry is having trouble with lines. So don't be upset. And I said, oh, this is a relief to me. Because so it became just I would deliver the line and someone would coach
you. But that totally was your green light to when he comes on set, go, you didn't prepare for the...
How long have you been in this business, Mr. Lewis? No, but he was very charming. I wish I had a bad story about him. He was, couldn't have been more charming and friendly. And I had just got done... We just got done watching a special tribute to Danny Kaye. And one of my favorite movies of all time was Court Jester, Danny Kaye. And this special about Danny Kaye... And again, he's one of those guys that came from a different world. You seemed that thing where he does all the Russian composers' names and the dancing and the sword fighting, and you don't realize how much work goes into what he did. So at one point, I didn't know what to say to Jerry Lewis. I said, "You must have known Danny Kaye," not knowing what he was going to say. But he gave me, he said, "Oh yeah," he says, "He loved the workload, but he did not like the hours." I said, "Oh, there's an insight." Yeah.
Wow.
It's almost like me, but I don't really like the workload, but I hate the long hours. I like a light workload and short hours.
The opposite way. So you're not like a workaholic. Like you don't you like to take some time and not sandwich.
I do. Yeah, I look back on it. I was starting things you do, you know, doing shows, 8 shows a week and 4 10-hour days. It's just not. And you read about people who are on a series, 16-hour days. I go home and had 4 hours of sleep.
Yeah,
I don't know. Is it worth it? Is it necessary? That's what I don't think.
Is it? Is the fame part of it not fun? Like, do you want to just? Would it be nice just like? Oh, I'm just a performer.
Well, you want fame, but you don't like to be recognized when you go out. At certain times, you like to have someone say, "Oh, Mr. Willard, hi." Especially with your friends or your family. Oh, I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. But you don't like at an airport with, "How do I know you?" That's not
right.
Those conversations never end up well.
Right.
Because you start listing your critics, and then. No. And then they get kind of angry because they don't know. Well, anyway, I never watched television.
I know that's always the I never watched television thing.
I never watched television. I don't know. Well,
if you don't watch television, then it's something you don't care about. So why would it matter if I'm on a thing that you've never seen before? Why are we having this conversation? Yeah, it is. I guess it is sort of a weird thing. I even just being on TV a little bit and... You know, if I'm in an elevator and then all of a sudden I'll see on Twitter someone go, "Hey, I saw you picking your nose in an elevator." And I'm like, "No!"
Yeah, that's scary.
It's just like, it's like a weird sort of like a surveillance. You know, there's like a public surveillance thing. And
it's real gross, though.
And I am weird about
it. It's disgusting.
Because I have this weird thing where I always think something's hanging out of my nose. And so I'm always just kind of like, I'll be in a conversation. I'll go, "I didn't check before this conversation. How do I know there's not like a friggin' rock wall hanging out of my nose right now?"
That's right. And if you talk with your hand over your face,
then that seems weird. Yeah. And then if you play with your nose too much, then they're like, "What the fuck is that guy on?"
And then if you're, with a curl, you say, "Is there anything in my nose?" That kind of, women don't like that.
And it's only right before sex. Is there anything in my nose?
Well, even before that, when you're starting to think about
it. Is there anything in my fucking nose before I fucking make love to you?
Yeah, that is a weird thing, though. I do have that. I don't know where that came from. It's not like I ever had some moment where, I was trying to, make some grand proclamation and someone was like, "Booger alert!" I don't know where it came from.
Well, it's something you can't control. You don't know. It's like something in your teeth. You don't know. You don't deliberately have something in your teeth or food on your...
If someone has something in their nose, do you tell them?
You tell me all the time.
you should.
You should. Because I'm tall, too. So it's like everyone notices.
You want people to... You want your friends to be like, "Hey," because that's what a friend does.
That's what a friend does. And they're not embarrassed by it.
But I find if someone tells me, "You got some food there," and momentarily I'm annoyed at that person.
Right. How dare you?
We've been talking for 5 minutes. This is the first time you said something. That's what I hate. Like when they finally say it, and you're like, what took you so long?
Why didn't you tell me that before I met the president? Well, it was a bad time.
I'll be out, my wife and I'll go out to some event. We go on 2 hours, come home. She'll say, "You look terrible in that shirt." I said, "Now you tell me. Why do you tell me when I put it on as we're getting into the car, don't wear that shirt again? You gave it to me." My wife has bought me jackets, and I'll put it on to wear it. She says, "I hate that jacket." "But you bought it for me."
"I know. I just wanted you to look ridiculous for a minute. It was a bad idea. It was a bad idea." Well, we're about at the end of our hour.
Well, what else is in comedy? What do we talk about?
I don't know. What
comics we like? Do we?
We talked about comics we like. We talked about Jerry Lewis. We talked a little bit about John Cleese.
Yeah, I love a new comic named Sebastian Maniscalco.
Oh, Maniscalco.
Maniscalco.
Yeah.
Oh, he's so funny.
Yeah.
Very good, and not very not. I haven't seen him for over a year, but he you can sit through his whole act. He never goes too blue.
Not too fucking dirty?
Not too fucking dirty. That shit, that pisses me off. And I'll say, fuck, waiter, what the fuck is going on?
Now the British waiter.
That is, bloody is a dirty word. I never figured that out. Bloody, that's a no-no word in England. Bloody
hell.
We had a friend, well, anyway.
No, you just started a story, and then you...
Yeah, sorry. Well, the first time I was with this comedy group, we went to London, and our friends were kind of pretentious friends. They were British the first day we were there.
Sure.
And they were in a restaurant, my one friend, and he asked the waitress they need a napkin. He said, waitress, could we have a nappy? Now, in London, a nappy is a baby's diaper.
Please tell me she brought him that.
No.
Here you go. What is this?
I got a good laugh. Yeah, nappy. And I also found working on the show a fanny is a very different dirty word.
It's a vagina.
Yeah. And we were using it when a fanny for fanny pack.
Yeah.
Your rear end is your fanny. How do these things get? How do words change meaning?
Yeah.
Why do we call Munich Munich when the Germans call it München? Why do we pick that up and call it Munich? Who are we?
We're dicks. We just have to tell them how to use their own language.
Germany, Deutschland.
Yeah. Deutschland, yeah.
I don't know. But I do know that I do have to run to the store and pick up a pussy pack.
That fits over your rear end, right?
Yeah. Come on,
or is
Fred.
Over your shirt?
Why you got to bring it to the butt?
Yeah.
You just made it really dirty. Well,
the testicle bag that you wear over your shoulder, that's the new thing, because it's better,
That's the new thing.
First. You go and ask for a ball bag. What? The thing you wear around your shoulder. In England, it has a whole different meaning.
I mean, those British are filthy.
Now, let me ask you one question.
Please.
If you do a special, you say you did a half-hour comedy special.
Yeah.
An hour, I watch comics. But then, will that draw an audience to come to see you in the club? Or do people say, well, we saw him and he was great?
As long as you don't do the same exact set.
But how do people know that?
They'll ask you, they'll ask you on Twitter. They'll go, hey, if I come see the show, is it going to be the jokes I already saw? Yeah. And you'll go, no. Because once your special airs, you kind of really can't do those jokes on stage anymore.
Yeah, but like a musician, isn't that funny? Because a musician, they want to see the greatest hits. And a lot of times I'll go to see a comic and I want to see him do a bit.
But I've
seen him do.
But a joke is like a magic trick. You know, like it's like a magic trick because like once people see the turn, that's why Tom Lehrer would do these songs and record them and then just not even go, well, people have heard them.
But there are types of jokes that can work on repeat, which is more of those kind of sketch jokes where it's, the comic brings up a premise and then, does a voice and acts out that character on stage. Those are always fun to see.
You want to see a bit.
Yeah, but not like a twist and a punch. And necessarily, you don't need to see those again, but you wouldn't mind seeing this performance.
Right.
Yeah.
You have solved that problem for me. Thank you. Realize the tweet a comic say, yeah, virtually you're saying, are you going to be funny? Am I going to enjoy you? Oh, yes. But then you're sticking your neck out. Oh, yes, you're going to be, am I going to laugh?
You're funny. You're on Twitter as well, which is very...
Yeah.
Is it Fred Willard or Fred underscore Willard?
I don't know.
I'm going to find this out.
Or a way to find
out. I'm going to find this out for people. It's fun to listen to someone Google. Bloop, bleep, bloop, bleep, bloop. Fred Willard. Oh, damn it, not Fred Quillard.
Hey, I just got a text. I'm on your show right now.
Oh, hey.
This is great. Fred, did you know you're on the Chris Hardwick show?
You are Fred underscore Willard. That's what I thought. Fred and then an underscore.
I'm not sure what that means. But
well, it's that little under. There's a line between the two because some other guy parked Fred Willard.
There's an author named Fred Willard.
Well, that's not fair.
Yeah.
He should really be. You're the more famous Fred Willard. Deserve the name.
I've never read his books, there was a big...
That must be the bane of his existence. No, I'm not the actor, Fred Willard.
Yeah.
I express things with...
I never have to say, no, I'm not the writer, Fred Willard.
Maybe we'll have to tell people at the top of the podcast. Our guest is Fred Willard. No, not the writer.
Yeah. Jesus. Incidentally, I just took on a big project at our house. My wife had some bushes cut down. There was a big panel in front of our house that now looked very mottled. I said, I'm going to repaint it. Now, that sounds easy. It took me 2 days. I repainted. It was about as big as this room. And from now on, I'm going to refer to myself when they say, you know, what do you do? Fred Willard, actor, painter.
Actor, painter.
Yes. I was done. I was after 4 hours, 5 hours, I spilled paint. There were drops. My wife came out, you're getting paint on the brick.
That's enough experience to put on a resume.
Yeah.
I'm a painter.
I think so.
What do you paint? Oh, murals.
Yeah, actor, painter. Do you still write novels?
I'm not a fucking writer. All right, so Fred underscore Willard on Twitter. You're welcome back anytime you want. It's always fun just to hang out.
Yeah, well, you have a very relaxing show, and it's fun to talk comedy. I love to talk comedy. I don't have many views on it. I mean, if I knew the solution to being funny, yeah, people must ask you. Do people ask you for advice starting out?
No.
They don't?
No, they do. They ask about advice about starting out, which is basically just... well, you just got to start out. You just have to just do jokes and then try them in front of people. And there's no magical start line. Like, it's just it's remarkable how anticlimactic it feels to start doing comedy. It's like, you just go up and you start doing it, and it, you know, that's it.
Jerry Seinfeld said something once that was kind of chilling. He says, comedy is hard if you're not funny.
Yeah.
And I suddenly realized all the times I've told stories about being on stage and not, you know, bad audiences. I said, was I just not funny? Which is very, obviously I wasn't at that time for that audience. Other times was I so funny that people laughed at things that just came to my head and weren't, I didn't mean to be funny.
Yeah.
And they laughed. But so it's.
Well, that's why the audience sort of, you know, that's why it's sort of a relationship. And in some cases you kind of know, like, this will probably be funny. And then other times you're sort of surprised, like, oh, that, you know, like there are some bits that I have that just in sort of riffing with the audience came out, I didn't think were particularly funny, and then they would laugh, and then the next show it would get a laugh, and the next show, and I still go, I don't really understand why this is funny, but yeah. I guess if this is what you're enjoying, then here's a heaping spoonful of it. I don't know. I think, you know, we don't always know, and the audience in our head is not always. I mean, I always assumed, well, the better you get at comedy, the more in tune the audience in your head gets with the audience who's actually coming to see you. Like, the more you have an understanding of, like, yeah, this will probably kill. But I still don't really feel like, I don't know. I still don't feel like I really exactly know.
But you're at the point now where people come to see you, which is great. And what I admire the most is the comics who come out on a TV show, their first TV appearance, because they're coming out, what you're saying is, I'm funny and I'm going to make you laugh. So, and it's always interesting to me how most of them get around that, and you end up laughing at them, and it's
hard to grab people in 6 minutes, especially if you're used to doing an hour.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, so much of what your hour can be is like, hey, you have a little bit of chance to contextualize everything. There's breathing room, but with 6 minutes or 5 minutes on television, it's like you better. There's no getting to know me period. It's like you have to come out swinging, and it better connect, or that's it.
Yes.
Or people just go, that guy's not funny. Like, but you saw a 6 minute. No, fuck that guy. I got no more room for that. I got no room for facts about bodies of water outside India. I got no more room for any of it.
Yes. It's like a pinch hitter coming into a baseball game.
Yeah.
Someone's saying, he's going to get a hit and save the game. And then more times than not, it's a strikeout or a grounder to shortstop. And then, the hit, though, makes it all worthwhile.
Well, it is that one sort of, if you have my very first comedy, like stand-ups that I ever did, I killed. And so I was hooked, but it took a while before that happened again.
Oh.
But it was still enough where I was like, God damn it, I know that it's going to happen. You know? So it's sort of I can never tell if it's good to kill your first time or bomb your first time. I just feel like if you have the comedy gene, if you have that need, you're going to do it no matter what.
Yeah.
And when people say, how do I start? You kind of go, well, if it's really important to you, if you can't stay away, then you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. It's not fun advice. Like, step one, you know, at 6:30 p.m., have a yogurt. Yeah. At 6:45, you know, open your notebook. At 7, like, it's not really that there are steps. It's just sort of, it's shocking how it's really just, well, you got to just do that.
Yeah. Just list four things that annoy you, and put down what is funny about them in the right column.
That was the old I remember that was the Judy Carter's stand-up comedy book.
Oh yeah,
that I bought when I was in college, and as much as people made fun of it, were like, "Oh, you can't learn stand-up comedy from a book." No, you can't learn stand-up comedy from a book. But what you can learn from a book is you can just learn ways to, like write down five things you hate, write down five things you love,
because it opens up that trap door,
opens it up,
more funny
gets you
come
thinking.
Out.
Yep. Yeah,
hey, I'm gonna go home and do that. Five things that annoy me.
Because honestly, people who don't know how to start wouldn't even think to just like. I think people just wait for the lightning to hit them. Rather than like, well, you kind of got to crank the lightning machine if you want the lightning. Yeah. Just, you know, like you have to sort of get the process going. And then, you know, it's, if you just sit around and wait for it, it may happen or it may not happen. But I think you're more in control of it than people realize. I think we're about at the end.
I'm at the end. Yes.
I mean, we all took cyanide pills at the beginning of the... I didn't tell you guys, but this is the end.
Oh.
So...
that's a nice way to go out.
Wait out these last couple of minutes.
I'm fine with that. Yeah.
Well, as we drift into the abyss together.
I kept it under my tongue. I fooled you both.
Damn it! Oh. Fred Willard!
This is the worst suicide pact. I knew it.
Why didn't we should have signed the pact?
Clearly, he's just a liar.
I just swallowed mine while I was laughing.
Oh God.
Best friends again.
I will haunt you, Kyle.
No. Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Whatever your legal document needs, LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more, they've got it. Over 12 years and 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom. Start your business or protect your family today at LegalZoom.com using the offer code Nerdist.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fu,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.